Welcome everyone to another edition of the NatCon Australia podcast, the bookish and based edition, the US presidential inauguration edition with Jordan Knight and myself. Jordan, I was going to start off by, before we get into the serious stuff, by asking you, because you're always, you always stress that with the new right, the aesthetic is as important as the substance. So what does the YMCA campaign song for Trump, what does it mean? What's the deeper significance of that? And, you know, what would the campaign song be in Australia or Europe? Or what should it be?
Yeah. Such a great question. I think it shows that Trump is just like this, like, massive walking contradictions. Like, he's this, like, you know, this New York guy, metropolitan, cosmopolitan dude who somehow is fighting for the heartland and just loves his four gay dudes dressed in, like, clothing and, like, you know, outfits, dancing. None of it really makes sense, and I think that's probably what it represents. But it's a bit of a throwback. You know, everybody sort of listens to the music of the peak, and that's, like, what, 80s? And I don't know, he was probably killing it in the 80s. I don't know, that's what I think. I don't know, it's a fun song. Yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts? Yeah. What do you think they do?
Well, I don't know. I just know that you're into, like, Jordan Bardella and, you know, European house and all the rest of it. And I just thought, like, hang, it doesn't really gel. Like, this literally this, is it not, it's not a boomer soundtrack, but it's certainly disco from a far gone era. And I don't know.
It's definitely go on.
Oh, no, you go, man.
I was just going to say, it's definitely kind of goofy in, like, a lighthearted way, which kind of, like, when they're trying to dial up the rhetoric, they're trying to dial it up to such a point where it's, you know, Trump is a fascist, and then he comes out, like, dancing and singing YMCA. Like, I'm not saying that this is, like, the 12D chess, but it kind of does suck all the air out of, like, these fascist allegations when he's, like, this goofy guy just, like, having a jig on stage.
It completely pulls the rug from that sort of thing. I think I saw a tweet the other day, or the last 24 hours, there's been so much news that it basically said, you know, the whole line that he was a fascist going to put gays in camps, and then it shows the performance of him literally dancing to the most campy village people song. It doesn't, you know, maybe that doesn't sort of ring true, but the other thing I was going to ask you, which I was quite keen to hear your thoughts on, is, you know, there's been a lot of news, but the threat that Trump has been making against Canada to annex it. What do you make of that?
That is an interesting, this expansionist sort of idea. It feels in a way like, I don't know if it's like a Trump idea where he kind of like is looking at a map of like North America and he's like, what are we doing about this here? You know, just drawing a big red circle, you know, and it kind of, he just seems like the kind of guy that sort of, because he's a property guy as well, right? Like, he probably sees unrealized land value or something. But I don't know. It feels like there's like there is an element, like, I have minor suspicions that there's like an element of like elite capture in a certain way, where the guys that are currently around Trump are really clued on about stuff that like we haven't even considered. Like, there's like, you know, Greenland, Canada. Maybe like what's the Peter Thiel game theory company that he owns? Not Plarion.
Escaped me, but I know the one.
Palantir. I wonder if like Palantir is like just telling him like, hey dude, also buy the Panama Canal.
Panama Canal was an issue like in Ronald Reagan's time in the 70s. So that's been a lot, but it sort of died as an issue and Trump's resurrected it. But I sort of feel like with some other talking points of Trump, you sort of see stuff bubble along on Twitter for a while and then he picks it up. Whereas with Greenland and even the Canada stuff, I don't feel like that was really in the ether before he threw it in there.
No.
So you do wonder where exactly that did come from. And
Well, JD Vance has said in that really excellent James Pogue piece in the Rolling Stones that I think was like 2 years ago, just before the midterms, JD Vance had an interview and he like explicitly said this was before he was in the running for vice president, and he was like, look, America is in like a late republic stage, and we're gonna have to get weird to sort of fix things. And I think, you know, if the late Republic, then what came next? I mean, wasn't it the Empire? Maybe they're starting to think empirically. I don't know.
Well, it was a massive civil war before that happened. But, yeah, before Augustus, the Baron of his day, came forward and seized the throne. But I also feel like with the Canada stuff, it's maybe I'm reading too much into this, but it's almost as though the most charitable one reading is it's sort of bullying at one level. It's not one level. I feel like it's not the greatest thing, but at the other time, it's like part of me thinks maybe he's just trying to encourage these existing nation states to sort of man up a bit and like take their own national seriously and define what it is that makes Canada distinctive from the United States and come on, Britain, you know, you got to be a nation state with your own interests like us. Be Britain first in the same way that I'm America first. I won't mind, right? Just stick up for yourself. I haven't seen that written, but I just sort of feel like I don't really think he's going to annex Canada. I feel like it's just a bit of a sort of Trump kind of mind game or deal making thing. And he's you know, at best, like I said, just trying to like G them up and be the best they can be. But who knows? That's
Yeah, that's a good point. He also does seem to be really sort of, I don't know if you're watching the interviews that he was giving when he was signing all the executive orders, but it really does give the impression that he really is like asserting America's power and dominance. And it's kind of like this sort of realization that, you know, he's, you know, sort of had about how important it is. And he's just going to use it and swing it around as much as possible. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. He might just be sort of saying, well, I'm doing this now, so you guys should do it too, like saying that to his allies. So, yeah, that's a completely plausible point, actually.
Or at least he wants to have a bona fide negotiation, you know, rather than simply sort of trying. Anyway, who knows with all these things? It's hard to keep up with all the executive orders that have been flying, but they have happened, right? Like with Trump, you're never quite sure whether he – especially after the first term, we did some stuff and other stuff he put on the back burner. But this time it's like boom, 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 you know, and there's personnel in place and there's websites being updated immediately. It's a much more kind of systematic, professional approach to taking control of the federal government, I think, right?
Yeah, this was a smooth regime change, I think. Yeah, it's incredible. Did you read the Curtis Yarvin New York Times interview or listen to it at all?
Oh, I saw a bit of it. Yeah, I read a bit of it. I've been to Curtis Yarvin before, but they were trying to make him out. Well, from what I read, they were sort of coming to it. They were like coming to him completely anew and not really like wanting to use him as a means of sort of, I don't know, scaring their readership or getting them all worked up for this, that, and the other. There wasn't like anything really that new to it, was there? I don't know. You tell me. What did you get from it?
No, not really, not really. I mean, Curtis Yarvin, you know, he always sort of downplays what he actually is saying, you know, which, you know, is what you would do on the New York Times. I don't know. I thought it was interesting. I mean, he kind of just likened him to you know, FDR. You know, one of the best lines he had was when they were talking about, you know, his belief that, you know, America should be run like a monarchy. And, you know, the journalist was prodding him on this and he sort of said, well, you know what? I mean, you know, you work for a monarchy. I mean, the New York Times is a five-generation hereditary monarchy. Like it, you know, it's extremely successful and well-liked. And it's all of those things because it's run like a monarchy. And, you know, I think that was a fantastic point. But he did make this really excellent, really interesting insight about Trump, where he said in the first term in 2016, and one of his major faults, Curtis Yarvin thinks, is that he's insecure. He's an outsider guy, right? Like he's a Queens dude, always sort of on the outside. You know, he's always, you know, compensated for that. He's been big, brash, and things like that. And in 2016, like a lot of, you know, I think what he was insinuating as well, Curtis, was that a lot of the combativeness of 2016 came from that insecurity. Like he was the outsider of outsiders. But when you watched him in the interviews today, he is so cool, calm, and collected. Like he's fully got his confidence back, and it's very, very interesting to see him having this confidence and this air about him where, yeah, it's just like such a comfortable, cool-headed sort of regime change. It just feels like there's no, like, there is minor tensions, but it's just no, it's kind of like it's done. It's over sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I feel like he knows his own mind and knows his own policy positions a lot better. And yeah, he did have that sort of status anxiety, I think, the first time when he got into the presidency, which seems weird, but there were reports on him. I actually read that book, one of the first ones that came out, which was Inside Trump and all the sort of chaos of the White House, and some of it was no doubt embellished, but he was like trying to curry up to New York Times reporters, which in 2016, which seems like a completely different age now. There's no reason for him to do that anymore, and he didn't, and he, you know, owns the media landscape and sort of redefined it in so many ways too. All that, like, so we talk about Canada, but Australia, I was just thinking, actually hasn't been in the crosshairs. It hasn't mentioned, like, Elon completely resurrected the grooming gangs thing in the UK. And Trump's onto Canada, and there's been pot shots at Europe and this, that, and the other. But we kind of haven't featured at all. And I'm wondering what will happen to the Australian body politic when the sort of the gaze of Sauron, you know, finally kind of hits our shores.
Mm. I had to say, I think unfortunately we are probably too irrelevant to really necessitate any really sort of major. I mean, they don't really care what's going on. It's a nation of like 25 million people.
But Elon cared with the misinformation laws and stuff. There was this period of time where we were getting, you know, a bit of a beating from him.
Well, he kind of just like tweeted like that's retarded and then kind of moved on. Whereas like the grooming gangs thing, he sort of took it pretty personally. There's like talk of him funding. Like it was obviously an ideological personal thing for him where, I don't know. In a funny way, I mean, Australia, because it hasn't had anything as bad at that scale as the grooming gangs. We kind of missed that. And also on the other hand, like we're just not that important in my opinion, not to downplay Australia. Obviously, I love Australia and stuff like that. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, we've got like a Labor government as well. We've got fucking Kevin Rudd, I think. Is it still Kevin Rudd over there?
He's still the ambassador. Yeah, I find that amazing that they've kept him, to be honest.
Mm.
He's not the personality type or simpatico at all to Trump positions. So why would you keep the dude? Like, just change him. Just tactfully change him within 3 months. You don't have to, like, just change him to someone else. He's going to tick off. He's going to tick off.
They need to send Mark Latham over, in my opinion. But they would match the star. I saw that Penny Wong. It's clear. I sort of am concerned that this is going to be the case. It's that Australia, you know, shit Australian politics will position itself as the antithesis to, you know, this right-wing Trump thing. And you kind of already got a glimpse of it today from Penny Wong when she's like, glad to be over in DC. Anyway, we caught up with India and Japan and just took photos of meetings with India and Japan delegates. It's like, dude, this is like the number one ally. And there's like very little sort of love given to the Americans. So I think, you know, the lefties up top in Australia aren't happy about Trump. So they're just going to probably just play to the global south or something like that. Like, yeah, depressing.
Well, they're not going to be able to avoid it. It is ridiculous. Like you said, I did listen. I've been sort of tuning in and out to the ABC to sort of with genuine curiosity as to what type of spin they'll put on it. Because it's at one level, it's their worst nightmare from hell. Like every single executive order is directly against what they believe and have been, you know, propagandizing for the last, well, God knows how long, right? And there's almost like, I feel like, considering the rhetoric beforehand when he was the new Hitler, everything else, there's almost like this resignation and sort of weird calm. They're sort of just like just reading executive orders. Oh, you know, he said that, you know, men can't be women, women can't be men. He's pulled out of Paris. He's pulled out of the WTO. He's getting rid of all the DEI. And it's like, and it's not, I sort of feel like they should be sort of screaming as they say that, but they're not. They're kind of just humming it. And, I actually think the Australian bureaucracy, it is not prepared for what is going to hit it, because it's not just Trump. As I think we've mentioned before, across the board now, you've got guys who are going to be responsible for these large US departments, which do have international, you know, cooperation with Australia in health, in security, and everything else. And, you know, Marco Rubio, who is, you know, he wasn't originally a Trumpy kind of guy, but, and he has many flaws, but at least he's politically astute. And he now, as is quite clear from his, like, not confirmation hearing speech, he at least gets the, what I would call NatCon, like the Trump kind of agenda on trade, immigration, and foreign policy. And it, I think that's been, hasn't quite been publicized enough in Australia, because he's sort of middle of the roadish, you'd say, right? You know, and a kind of a likable dude, impressive speaker, was never on the Trump page, but has now kind of made peace with him. He's probably not a bad guy for foreign, yeah, Secretary of State. Yeah. And Penny Wong is meeting him. He's one of the first meetings. And so when he meets her and he kind of gives her the line from his speech, which is worth quoting, it says, you know, here in America and in many advanced countries across the world, an almost religious commitment to free and unfettered trade at the expense of our national economy shrunk the middle class, left the working class in crisis, collapsed industrial capacity, pushed critical supply chains into the hands of our adversaries and rivals. And she's going to go like, oh, yeah, we've sort of just sorted our free trade agreement with China, and they continue to allow them to import 100% manufactured goods from China, and we sell them lobsters and wine. It's going to be like, well, and by, supported on a bipartisan basis. Oh, that's great, Penny. And then you've got like, you know, an irrational zeal for maximum freedom of movement has resulted in a historic mass migration crisis here in America and around the world that threatens the stability of societies and governments. And Penny's going to go, oh, yeah, we've got this great new labor mobility agreement with India, which, as you well know, is sort of de facto open borders for anyone with a degree from India. I don't know. I just feel at some point these guys, DFAT and everyone else, is just going to have to go. And that's without even getting into the health stuff where, you know, the Jay Bhattacharyas and the RFKs are going to go, I'm sorry, we're not going to kind of do deals with your, with, you know, health bureaucracy as long as you continue to, you know, continue with the crazy lines that you had during COVID. I don't know. What do you reckon? How's that going to, are they just going to put their hands in their ears and go la, 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 or what?
Yeah, I guess, I don't really know. I mean, maybe you remember from the first Trump term, because I was kind of checked out, especially on foreign policy. I mean, does it influence Australian politics that much when you know, Trump is in charge in America? My thought would have just been that they, you know, they send the occasional tweet like, oh, this Australia should, you know, protect free speech, and then that's about it. Nothing really happens. Like, how influential could it be? Like, will anything actually change because America says so, or not really?
Well, I mean, it's a good point. Like, because there was, Scott Morrison was in charge, I think, for most of the Trump era, first Trump era. And, you know, they were, most of their line was, in fact, Scott Morrison gave a speech back in the day, Lowry Institute speech, where he basically was reassuring people, oh, no, regardless of what this crazy man in the White House has said, we haven't changed our view on immigration and trade and foreign policy, and we'll just make it better, and sort of defining themselves against it in the same way that a Labor government or anyone would. And they still, I mean, you know, they still have not got it. The lead opinion writers in The Australian, the centre-right political class in Australia, they do not believe and have not said anything like the stuff that, you know, good old Marco Rubio has said. Like, you know, they it's crazy. I mean, read like, it's not just Trump, you know, crazy madman, you know, like tweeting away. This is now like a comprehensive argument and agenda. You can't just sort of like fob it off, I reckon. And who, I mean, you know, no signs at all, you know, like any signs, you follow the immigration stuff as well, any signs from any mainstream political party that they're going to tear up the India mobility agreement or reduce immigration in any serious way?
No. I mean, no, I think it needs to be said that, like, you know, were it not for Trump, that the Republican Party would still be exactly the same, like, as the Liberal Party, which would, yeah, still be like a largely leftist, open free market sort of theme. So, you know, Trump is like this exogenous sort of force that sort of completely changed the GOP forever, hopefully. And we don't have that, like the level of influence. Like, yeah, it's so hard to see. It's so hard to see how Australia will, if it ever does, mimic what happens in America. It just very simply might not. Like, I hate to be the doom saying black-pilled, you know, guy here, but like, maybe it just doesn't. Maybe we just have this perma-shit politics and actually America just flourishes with tariffs and good, better politics. Yeah, what do you think?
See, I was actually diving in to like, okay, so Australia Day is coming up and everyone, all the centre right are like, oh, the left have got this black arm view of history when it comes to Australia Day. But the right have a black arm view of history when it comes to federation. And we, when we imposed tariffs at when we established our nation as a nation state, right? Like the 26 was just, you know, Arthur Phillip rocking along and claiming the stuff. But we established a restrictive immigration and protectionist trade policy at federation, Trumpian policies. And part of the kind of impetus behind that was David Syme, a rich businessman from Victoria, who basically funded a lot of politicians like Alfred Deakin and other people, Edmund Barton, who funded that and promoted that and argued for it in the press of in the Age, you know, which is obviously has a different reputation now, for many, many years. And you read his stuff and he's talking, he has Trumpian lines. So it does require some big dog, I think, to come in and shake things up, as well as people who, you know, can publicize and make the arguments too. But, you know, maybe it'll happen, maybe it will. I was going to ask you on, because there's so much that really went on since we've last spoken, and the Vivek Ramaswamy has kind of crashed to earth in a major way, right?
I was actually amazed that it sounds like he's been ousted from Doge as of today. So he's on the way out. Yeah, that is a... that will likely be an ongoing debate, but it very much seems like the I don't know what you'd call it, the American workers, I don't know, heritage Americans kind of won that argument, which is interesting as well in itself, because it was like largely had online. Like it was this interesting right-wing in-flight. Yeah.
Completely online. I remember I was down the South Coast, New South Wales, and I was sort of, you know, with my parents, and they were getting they only read the hard copy paper. No mention at all of that entire debate, very actually little mention of any of the grooming and stuff too. So you've got this massive fight between some major personalities in the new government. It's not even rating a mention in the press, like the hard copy press in Australia. Vivek Ramaswamy seems to have sort of blown himself up by not getting what is really the core of the kind of MAGA stuff on immigration. It's not just cross like illegal immigration on the border. It's like, no. This stuff has to be, you have to be protecting your own people and looking after your own people first before you're hiring the best and brightest from around.
There was that one line where he tweeted out where he's like, you know, America first is about America coming first. And it was like, oh, dude, have you not clock that? Like, that's a fundamental misunderstanding. Like, actually, it's about Americans coming first, like they're putting Americans first, not America like winning this free trade race sort of thing. So yeah, it really, that debate was I still have to sort of think about how to sort of position my argument without sounding bigoted. I'm sure there's a way to explain it without seeming so, but it really, like, to be perfectly blunt, it almost sort of, there was kind of factions in that almost looked like ethnically aligned or nationally aligned rather than just like rational debates. Like it very quickly devolved into in-group.
Elon, even though it's now forgotten, he was the sort of first mover on that. He was the one talking about how we need, like those tech guys who were a very welcome addition to the whole party, including Mark Zuckerberg, who's now, you know, talking about masculine energy and getting rid of DEI, which is sort of unbelievable to to think about anyway. Yeah. But they were all in on Trump towards the end, but I don't think they truly understood many aspects of it, because they were sort of they were Johnny come latelys, to be honest. And they hadn't thought deeply about the immigration stuff. So they just assumed, we'll stop the people at the border and let's just like hire whomever we want from wherever. And they did. We could tell that even Elon, he wasn't across the details of the H-1B visa stuff in any detail. Like you could just tell he hadn't thought about it. He sort of assumed it's like hiring, you know, German rocket scientists and stuff, which is not how it operates.
No. No, that's right. And as well, it needs to be said too, I mean, like, trust me, like the immigration debate, it unfortunately gets extremely personal, extremely seriously. I mean, even Elon sort of said, I came over here on H-1B. Like he obviously immediately took it really personally. And it's like, dude, we get that. Like we're not saying that you suck because you're on H-1B. What we're saying is like it's being rorted and it's fundamentally disadvantaging American workers. But yeah, that debate, I feel like that is like the worst debate in a way, because it really, more than anything else, becomes personal.
It is a rough debate, but you know, it's just amazing how Twitter just focuses and gets to goes deep diving into it. Like they pulled up all the H-1B sort of visa categories which were available online, and then you had this whole swarm of people just going through it line by line to working out someone's getting an H-1B visa to be the assistant coach in friggin', you know, some like one cow town in the middle in the Midwest, right? And so clearly, you know, I wasn't even aware of that, like how the extent of the rort. It's always worse than you think. And I'm sure Elon wasn't. And I'm sure he kind of like, it did give him pause for thought. In fact, he did towards the end sort of soften it and start to come to us a bit more of a kind of reasonable position, saying we just need the best and brightest. And if there's rorting or something along those lines, then we should cut it down. He just misunderstood what the visa category was about. So,
going back to what you're saying as well about how it didn't really feature in the news. I mean, I'm sure you've been seeing as well, there's been a bunch of continued sort of newsroom cuts and seems like there's more looming. And I just really think we are entering a sort of digital first world. I think I was talking about this before, where like what happens online sort of leads the news and the news just reports on that rather than people talking online about what happens in the news, if that makes sense. So it's kind of flipped completely.
It does. As you know, I did a podcast with Amy Therese, who's she's a, you know, pretty influential little Twitterer from Xer from Sydney, and who comments a lot on American politics. And she doesn't know much about what's going on in Australia, but she, you know, interviewed JD Vance and a whole lot of other things. And I was discussing with her and saying, yes, it like the online X News is so much superior to, as we know, everything that's published in the mainstream press, but there's still a huge body of the population that isn't as clued into it. And I'm not sure, and while you might be able to say, oh, yes, these online debates, they do eventually work their way and change the thing, sometimes they don't. And sometimes you've got this this stuff which, you know, you've analysed to death, and it's just not possible then to sort of quickly download all that to someone who hasn't been involved in the debate. And it comes across as very difficult to sort of, they immediately reject it because they haven't been following along with the story. And then you suddenly dump this new information on them and you think, oh, this is, you must be kind of like in the rabbit hole areas of the internet. And I've been told that's kind of crazy stuff. I mean, there really is that type of attitude. And I think, frankly, a lot of the pollies in Australia, they still think of social media as either something, you know, to be regulated the hell out of, or as purely a distribution mechanism for a press release that they used to do by traditional means. They don't see it as a resource to engage and learn stuff from and you know, to improve their own policy and messages. And I actually think that from the go-get, that was Trump's secret weapon, right? It wasn't just his bombastic statements on Twitter. He was actually kind of learning what people were thinking about, so that when you engage with a Jeb and he's been talking to his policy advisors, he's just completely out of touch with the current you know, news wave. But anyway.
Yeah. I was just going to say, yeah, it's got a faster feedback loop. And I do think, you know, my mom now is even starting to watch more and more, you know, content online as opposed to television. She was like an ABC diehard. And I swear she's increasingly right wing because of it. It's to our advantage that things are shifting online. But yeah.
As you probably know, you know, there's rumors about, you know, cutting further cuts at Sky. There's you know, the major mastheads are not a growing industry. So who knows what it will look like and who knows what people will rely on. I just still feel like, you know, yes, there's some savvy kind of, you know, types like yourself and who follow it, and I have too, but there's still a large body of the population who have simply got no, they're waiting to read Greg Sheridan to tell them what has happened in the States overnight, and it's not as good. It's limiting. And hey, mate, I was going to ask you too. Like, there was this another little. Let's just, you know, take Twitter debates and put them more in the mainstream. That the bootstrap narrative, that was another one that went in the last sort of 2 weeks, where there was this attitude that I'm not sure where it originally came from, but it was all, you know. Maybe it's a perennial thing, but it was this boomer line that, oh, look, people, the young people that these days just need to pull themselves up from their, oh, that's right, work at Panda Express, which is a UK, US right, chain. Yeah. Do you remember what was the
what sparked that? I don't remember what sparked that. I think it was a sort of like an ember from the H1B sort of debate. And for some reason, right-wing guys, like new right guys, like Christopher Rufo and some others. Who are otherwise very good, sort of said, well, actually, look, you know, stop complaining because, you know, a young man in America today can work at, I think it was like Chipotle or something like that, and work their way up and get $120K as a manager at Chipotle. And, you know, again, it just caused this huge, it's been amazing actually, like the amount of, it feels like the workers of America are really finding their voice online. But
people like Chris Rufo has been a bit of a champ, I think, over the years, like exposing woke. And but you're only kind of one sort of bad takeaway from being, you know, having the whole a target of hate, really. It's a bit sort of.
Yeah, like, I think he keeps unfortunately making. Yeah, I don't know what's happening over there, to be honest.
They don't see it correct or something, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a donor thing. I'm not too sure. And he's still very effective, I mean, it's just like another. I mean, it seemed very artificial. I mean, either artificial or like completely removed from the truth of it. Yes, you can. I can go and work at McDonald's and work my way up, and you know, become a manager and then an area manager, and maybe I'll be on maybe 130K. By the time that happens in like 10 years, like house prices will have doubled. like 130K would be like the equivalent of like 80K. Like it's like, why would you tie yourself to a sinking ship? I think that's what the problem is that the problem isn't so much that like, oh, we're better than working these jobs. It's like, well, actually we work these jobs and we get diminishing returns, and we have been for 20 years, and there's no point to it. Like that's, I think, is the problem. Well,
yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with the message about everyone should be encouraged to sort of like be resourceful and whatever, but it's the disconnect between the reality of what that means in this day and age. They assume the same kind of housing prices are the same as they were when they were a kid, that the whole environment is the same, and it's just, it's the reaction is more like a kind of scream that, no, hang on guys, that rule doesn't apply anymore. I mean, don't pretend it does. It's sort of insulting to believe that it does. You need to. It was more like a kind of cry to say, like, don't give us the sort of bootstraps lecture unless you're willing to recognize the policy changes that have made things so tough and be willing to work out, like, suggest off ways in which they can be corrected. That's the main thing. Free advice like that. it's an isolation is gratuitous. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a matter of priorities, right? It's like there are like 700 more important things that people like Rufo and others should be focusing on that genuinely do improve the living standards of Americans, as opposed to telling him to go get a job elsewhere. Like I sort of do agree a little bit that like the right does have a tendency. It's like the left is like manic depression and bipolar disorder, then the right is like depression, right? Like there's a lot of doom and gloom on the right. Yeah, right. Yeah. So, you know, I do get this, yes, things are bad and getting worse, but, you know, maybe get creative about it. Anyway, I mean, you know, these fights are worth having. People sort of say don't infight. I actually think this is worth doing.
Oh, I think they've been really good at clarifying. As long as people can kind of argue the policy and stuff, it's actually useful. And but maybe that's why YMCA works, because it's sort of like a happy pill to the black pill sort of tendencies of the right. You know, you can go up and dance your goofy song and before discussing, I don't know, crazy cartels at the border and whatever the world's going to pot.
can I ask on that subject? I mean, you have kids, right? What do you expect the future is going to look like in sort of 20 years? Like, what do you see? Do you see like a Brazilification, like, or is that too extreme, or what?
Well, I think it has to change. Like, it absolutely has to change. And it has to change in the ways that we've been kind of trying to outline. You know, it has to be much more of a focus on trying to not just create this sort of, as I like to say, this country is a bundle of liberal axioms, but like, no, we're focusing on ensuring our people and our culture and our traditions and our rights and our language and everything else and our families are transmitted to the next generation, as they were until, you know, baby boomer liberalism kind of arrived and said all that kind of doesn't matter, or that shouldn't be the kind of core focus. So, you know, I just think once we lost the sight of that, it became a kind of chaotic free-for-all, both at an economic level and also at a social level. So, you know, look, yes, I think parents always worry. Unless things do change, life will be worse for them. But I don't know, dance YMCA and try and be a bit happy while before the gloom arrives. Because I mean, look, but like, yes. In some ways, it's the outlook is not great. But at the same time, you know, there's so much like potential for this technological transformation. It's like clearly change in the ether as well. You know, you always have the capacity with every age to make a difference. I don't think like so give it, like, I mean, this is like, it sounds like a pep talk, you know, just bootstrap yourself, man. but I think you do have to recognize that it's not like you're always a product of impersonal, historical and whatever global forces. You actually have, they impact on you, but you also do have the capacity to change them. At least I hope, you know. So,
That is a message that, like, I think one of the unspoken really good guys, he just gets spoken about, but, you know, people always talk about Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, but I think Mark Andreessen has been, like, one of the most consistently good Silicon Valley right guys. And he sort of said, you know, America has all the parts it needs to create a golden age. It has the human capital. It has the resources that will enrich it forever, sort of thing. It has ingenuity. It has the position, you know. So it really is just a matter of sort of getting all those together, sort of thing. So it can be done. The same can be said about Australia.
And England too. I mean, England is always held up as the absolute, you know, most doomed case in many ways of amongst the Western society, at least the friends I know. And there was a good little post by, is it your mate, what's his name, Sidwell, at least the guy you've met? Is it Sidwell? Sam Bidwell, yeah. And he had a great little post saying, look, these are all the assets of England, great universities and language, just went through them all. And you're thinking to yourself, yeah, you know, that they're like top notch. You know, at least at least look at the assets you've got first before looking at all the liabilities and everything else. But in theory, you know, you've got these are treasures that no one else has and can fall back on. So you do have the capacity to sort of tap the well. And is it, in some ways, it is worse than like Alfred the Great's time when the Vikings were in there and he was like stuck in the marshes and they were literally trying to, you know, commit genocide on the Anglo-Saxons. So things have been grim before. You know, there's that famous thing, I think, like where it shows the Spaniards were basically wiped out and no one would have thought that this little tribe of, you know, 100,000 people in the north of Spain would basically reconquer Spain and then go on to conquer the entire, you know, known world. So it is possible to come back from a very low point. But I, at the same time, it is unprecedented stuff in England. Like there's been more immigration to the UK in the last 20 years than the last 2,000 years. And that doesn't... Yeah, there was a stat which said that in Canada, that the male ratio in the 20 to 29 section in Canada is worse than the sex ratio male female in China, India, and Pakistan because of the influx of immigration. And you're thinking to yourself, that's a killer stat, but is not anywhere near as well known as it should be. Unprecedented. Like, you know, when has that ever happened in the past? Which ended nicely.
That is very true. Yeah. It does, when you say stuff like that, or the fact that, you know, some Australian cities are now like 50% foreign born, you know, things like that. It's okay. Yes. Something will have to change. But again, you said, yeah. Sorry, go on.
I was just saying, pre-Federation, which is why I'm interested in the Federation stuff, there was a very large, in like 1890, there was like 50% overseas born. And then like by 1910, there was like back to 10%. So there have been dramatic, admittedly, a lot of them were European. It wasn't quite the same. But even so, there are ebbs and flows. It's just that you need to be able to eventually flow back the other way, and I worry whether we have the capacity for that at the moment.
Well, there is a historical precedent in that, you know, like you say, we are always sort of outnumbered in a way, and there are stories where despite that they've nevertheless won and obviously survived. So I guess this is in a very historical way. This is kind of business as usual, but I don't know. There's always a final battle, right? There's always a last stand.
Young man, there's no need to feel down. Young man, get yourself off the ground. There's a place you can go.
Right. I'm cured. I'm no longer black-pilled. Thank you, YNCA.
Hey, man, I'll leave it there. I'm sure there'll be stacks more to discuss as this stuff filters down in the next few weeks, but... there's a lot of other different guests coming on, which people can tune into if they like. And be sure to check out Jordan's Twitter account, both your own account and also Migration Watch, because it should be the main issue of the next federal election, even though it's not. But immigration, because it dwarfs all other issues, it's hugely important. And eventually, hopefully, the political class will realize that. But
we tried, hey? We tried. Maybe as always next time. As always next time.
Cool, mate. Leave it to it. Have a great one. Right. See ya.
Cheers, guys. See ya. Bye.